This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Here's Mike O'Neill without Mike Russell, flying solo. It is candidate night this evening. First of all, candidate, singular, for Attorney General Felicia Rodellini. Her opponent, Mark Berkovich, was invited and did not respond. You're still welcome, Mark, if somebody on your side's listening, would be happy to have you. But we have Felicia Rodellini here, and we will have Terry Goddard, Secretary of State candidate, in the next half hour. But we've got two segments up front. You are running, Felicia, for Attorney General. What should the voters know about you?
Well, the voters should know that I have been a frontline prosecutor and financial watchdog for over 17 years. I had the opportunity to be an assistant attorney general and prosecutor in the attorney general's office for 13 years, working under both Republicans and Democrats. And then I ran a state agency for both Governors Napolitano and Brewer.
And that agency was?
The Department of Financial Institutions that regulates financial services in the state of Arizona. And my goal is to take politics out of the attorney general's office. It has to be an independent watchdog. And when I'm attorney general, I will rise above partisan politics and put the people first.
Now, what do you think is the most important priority for running the attorney general's office?
Well, you have to realize the attorney general's office is the largest law firm in the state, with 300 to 400 lawyers that represent all of the Arizona state agencies. They also have a criminal division where we prosecute financial fraud, statewide fraud, drug cases, and also Medicaid fraud. So the most important, I think, responsibility of the Attorney General's office or the Attorney General is to be a good lawyer for the people of Arizona, to be a great administrator of this office called the Department of Law, and to always have the culture where you put the people of Arizona first, because the client for Arizona's lawyer is the people.
You know, it's interesting. That's a little bit of difference in tone in this regard. I've always observed people running for Attorney General, not everyone, but the vast majority, stress the criminal side. And I've heard estimates of the criminal component of the AG's office at about 30%. And that's from a former attorney general.
That is about right. 30%. Street crimes are prosecuted at the county attorney level, and they have original jurisdiction for street crimes. The attorney general's office, as the top law enforcement officer for the state of Arizona, very involved in financial fraud, crushing the financial backbone of organized crime, the drug cartels, statewide importance. I want to make sure that the attorney general's office aggressively prosecutes consumer fraud and financial fraud. That is my expertise. And we need to make sure that we send a message to our communities that if scam artists are out there, especially preying on our seniors, they need to know somebody is out there who will prosecute them and hold them accountable. And that's what I've done for 17 years, and that's what I want to do.
So as I understand it, and I think you confirm, a street crime, run-of-the-mill burglary, robbery, that's county prosecutor.
Absolutely.
White-collar crime, more the purview of the attorney general?
Absolutely.
What about on the civil side? What are the main responsibilities?
On the civil side, anytime the state gets sued, and I'm talking about a highway design case, an employment issue, the attorney general's office has a huge department of lawyers that act as defense attorneys, defending the state in all of these lawsuits. And then, of course, every regulatory body. When I was in the attorney general's office, I represented the departments of real estate, insurance, and banking, now the Department of Financial Institutions, and the Arizona Board of Accountancy that regulates CPAs. The business of government is making sure business runs fairly and is also in compliant with the law. And so there's a huge number of lawyers that do that work. And then again, Child Protective Services and this new agency, Office of Child Welfare, there's over 100 lawyers in the Attorney General's office that are in the courts every day representing Child Protective Services, this new agency, and doing all the cases relating to adoption, foster care, parental termination. So it's really a big law firm, and you need to have somebody in charge that's going to have the right culture.
Now, Mark Berkovich isn't here, so I went to his website to see how he might weigh in. And one of the prominent things on his wife's on his website is, in effect, I will oppose Obama by challenging him in court. The language that he used on the website was defend against federal overreach. What are your thoughts on that, and how big a part of the Attorney General's office do you think that is?
Well, I believe there are definitely areas of federal overreach where we need to protect our turf. And the most important area right now, the most pressing area, is with respect to the EPA and some new rules that have been proposed under what the EPA calls the Clean Power Act. Clean Power Plan. And those rules would have a very draconian impact on the state of Arizona.
What do the new rules do?
These rules are designed to reduce carbon emissions, and in particularly the kinds of emissions that come from coal-fired electricity generating plants. Actually, Arizona has a very balanced energy plan. We get our electricity from solar. We get it from coal-fired generating plants. We also get it from nuclear plants. And these rules would actually be very detrimental to economic development. I'm all about fair policies that protect our environment, but I've met with our electricity providers, Tucson Electric, SRP, APS, and the Department of Environmental Quality is very concerned, and that's an area where I believe we need to fight the federal government.
I'm sort of hearing Navajo Power Plant. Is that loom large in this regard?
The Navajo Power Plant issues have actually been resolved with the EPA. There are other rules that are going to be promulgated that relate to the Clean Power Plan that will impact the Navajo Generating Plant, and I think we need to make sure we keep that plant open.
Okay. We will be back covering other remaining issues.
Yes.
We're going to talk about endorsements and
yes.
other things as well. As we go to break, I would remind you that back issues of the Think Tank can be found at mikeoneal.org. The last issue or two is available on the ktar.com website, and we will be back in just a moment with Attorney General candidate Felicia Rodolini.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're back in The Think Tank with Felicia Rodolini, candidate for Attorney General. In our first segment, you outlined some views that you have on what the role of the Attorney General is in the state of Arizona. Now, your opponent is not an incumbent. He hasn't done that. But I wonder if you might contrast for us the way you see your role from the way the incumbent, Tom Horn, has behaved as Attorney General, just by way of giving the listener an idea of how you see the role different.
Well, first and foremost, again, I can't emphasize enough the need to take politics out of the Attorney General's office and to make the decision-making about what is in the best interest of the people, the client of the Attorney General, and to focus on prosecuting criminals and protecting Arizona families. I believe what I will be doing is returning that office to that core mission of prosecuting criminals and protecting Arizona families. There are areas that I think have been neglected the incumbent has not spent enough time on, and I mentioned it in the first segment, financial fraud, white-collar fraud, consumer fraud, particularly against our seniors. I also believe we need to prosecute sex trafficking, which has become an issue in Arizona, and I also want to go after online sex predators that prey on our children. That's another area that we haven't seen enough prosecution in. And I also want to make sure that we improve our prosecution and prevention of domestic violence. We need to do that statewide. As the top law enforcement officer, the Attorney General has the opportunity to work at the county and local areas with victim services and to make sure we're doing everything we can to prosecute and prevent domestic violence. So those are the areas, I believe, the substantive areas where I think the current Attorney General has missed the mark.
Now, you haven't said anything about that hotbed issue. illegal immigration.
Yes. Well, oh my goodness. And one of my priorities is absolutely, thank you for reminding me, going after the organized criminals at the border, the human smugglers, the drug smugglers. And frankly, that is an area where Mr. Horn has been spending his time. I will continue to dismantle the organized criminals, the drug cartels. There are task forces ongoing with levels of law enforcement, the AG's office, the county, the sheriff, the local law enforcement. The attorney general has the ability to use forfeiture laws, RICO laws, to hit these cartels where it hurts the most, and that's getting seizing their profits.
Now, what is the status? There was some discussion, and I think possibly a law passed some time back, which had the effect of charging individuals who themselves crossed the border with a charge of smuggling, a serious felony. You know, what's the status of that? And is that within discretion or what?
Yeah, again, I believe that was the promotion made by a county attorney, Andrew Thomas. Again, we're looking at street crimes, we're looking at pulling folks over, and that's something that the county attorneys would have the opportunities to prosecute that and to arrest that. That was part of SB 1070. The United States Supreme Court ruled that those aspects of SB 1070 are still viable. The attorney general, the county attorneys, law enforcement have the right to protect citizens within our borders. We may not have jurisdiction over the flow of immigration and what happens across international borders, but we absolutely can protect our citizens within our borders.
But I think I'm hearing you say that calls like that are primarily county
They're
calls.
Local. They are absolutely local because that's where it's happening, on the street. Mm-hmm. It's local law enforcement, police departments, working with the local prosecutors, the county prosecutors. That's a discretionary call that they can make. My job as attorney general, when I'm attorney general, is to protect Arizonans statewide. And organized crime, financial fraud is one of the most important areas that the attorney general can make a difference every day. And I can't emphasize enough the very boring, very non-sexy job of making sure the business of government runs smoothly. If you are licensed, you have any kind of business license, there is a very good chance you are regulated by a state agency, and that state agency gets all of their advice from assistant attorney generals. So the culture of the attorney general's office and the tone from the top needs to be do the right thing for the right reasons, be fair, provide due process, and then protect the people of Arizona, and be a good steward of taxpayer money.
Let me ask you to respond to one thing. Again, this comes off of Mark Berkovich's website, because he's not here, so I went there. He says, in his website, says, under your watch as Department of Financial Institution Supervisor, quote, Arizona became ground zero for mortgage fraud and lending scams that brought the entire housing market crashing down.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. I was appointed superintendent in 2006, and the first thing I did was create a mortgage fraud task force. Because of my background as a former criminal prosecutor in the Attorney General's office, I saw what was happening. The FBI had disbanded their financial fraud task force after 9/11. So law enforcement was not looking at mortgage fraud, and it was rampant. And loan officers that were calling into people's homes were not licensed. Many of them had criminal background and criminal records, and they were stealing people's identity. And that's one of the reasons our boom of our real estate market was so high and the bust was so low. So I take amazing exception to Mr. Brenovich. He's frankly making that stuff up, because when I was there, we got mortgage loan officers license. It took us 2 years working across the aisle with Republicans to get loan officers who are now licensed. So if you get a call from a mortgage loan officer into your home, they have a license. They've been passed a test. There are no more felons in the industry, and they have skin in the game, and they better comply with the law.
I mean, I remember realtors talking about that period, and one of the phrases they used, they called these things liar's loans.
Yes, and liar's loans were a perfect tool for a scammer to lie, have a borrower or a straw borrower. I mean, they would literally make the borrowers up, and because the lending community and Wall Street was so thirsty for these loans to sell them to the secondary
Everybody seemed to be making commissions. Right. I wasn't thinking so much of a fictitious borrower, which would be absolute fraud.
Yeah.
But a case where somebody, everybody involved knew that the stuff wasn't being checked.
Right. And a lot of emphasis on subprime loans and getting folks that really didn't qualify for a loan into a loan that eventually would be foreclosed upon. So I was at the forefront nationally on going after mortgage fraud and cleaning up the mortgage industry. I did that with Republicans and Democrats and the industry leaders as well. And again, he can't touch my record either as the head of the Department of Financial Institutions going after mortgage fraud or my 17 years in the trenches making sure Arizonans were safe.
I do want to ask you about endorsements. You got the Republican endorsement. And I want to tell you, as somebody who watches these sorts of things, when you get endorsements from elected officials and it's in your party,
who cares?
I mean, that's to be expected.
Right.
This is a dog. But do you have endorsements from Republicans?
I have great endorsements from Republicans, like former Maricopa County Attorney Rick Romley, who gave my opponent his first prosecutorial, his only job, his first job, and he's endorsing me. Jerry Colangelo is endorsing me. I have the Arizona Association of Realtors.
You've got about 20 seconds to make your case. You can stay
and
an endorsement.
All the law enforcement, the whole law enforcement community in the state is backing me up. And the firefighters, because they know I'm about protecting and serving the people of Arizona. And that's been my record. And so I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be here. Just know I'm a child of small business and first-generation college graduate who grew up in the West. And so I will always be an independent voice for the people of Arizona.
Okay, this is Felicia Rodellini, candidate for Attorney General of Arizona. Her opponent, Mark Berkovich, is welcome here anytime. And after the break, we will return with Terry Goddard, candidate for Secretary of State.
Thanks so much, Mike.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Okay, we continue candidate night in The Think Tank. Our guest is Terry Goddard, candidate for Secretary of State. His opponent, Michelle Reagan, was invited to join us. Her staffer said that she had a scheduling conflict. Welcome to the Think Tank.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're running for Secretary of State. What are the priorities that you have for the office?
Well, there are two big ones. The first one is to get more Arizonans engaged in elections. This is, I guess, to be charitable, you'd say that our election system is a mess. Secretary of State is the chief elections officer, is responsible for straightening it out. In the past, responsible for getting us in this mess, but that's a different story. And the second one is what has happened fairly recently, really in the last 4 years, and that's called dark money. It's the anonymous corporate cash that's pouring into Arizona elections, trying to buy our votes, and frankly, I believe is undermining our democracy in a very insidious way. So trying to get more people involved so that we can get Arizona back to the state I grew up in, which was a very inclusive, very innovative, very exciting place to live. And somewhere we turned our back on that. And I think part of it was because an awful lot of moderate voters went to the sidelines. They'd had enough.
Well, I want to move on to those issues back in a minute, but I want to make an observation first. I've watched people running for years for Secretary of State, and there's always some kind of an agenda. And then you look at the actual job description, and it seems to be ministerial. And to kind of paraphrase John McCain about the vice presidency, it seems, other than ministerial record keeping, it seems to have the primary duty of inquiring daily into the health of the governor.
Wishful thinking, perhaps.
Well, and that was mentioned in your Republic endorsement, by the way. Congratulations on that endorsement.
Thank you.
But the gist or one of the central tenets of that of that endorsement was this is somebody who is ready to step in and be governor if that's called for. But back to the general point, I've heard this over and over, and I'm going to do that. Can you think of, before we get to your plan, can you think of a Secretary of State in Arizona's history who actually did something beyond the ministerial?
Actually, I want to give credit to Ken Bennett. He went out and found an orphan agency, in this case, the Arizona Department, the Archives, Records and Archives, and adopted it and brought it into the Secretary of State's office. So I give him high marks for that for a couple of reasons. One, I think you're absolutely right in saying that the Secretary set for the elections function and the registration of lobbyists and the taking down of various candidate and office holder financial statements.
But that's still in the realm of record keeping. I mean, I'm not saying that it's unimportant. I'm saying that it's not policy.
And I will take the opportunity to quote my opponent, although she's not here, unfortunately, and I would love to have the chance to compare notes with her. But in one of our first and very rare joint appearances, she said that it was the world's or the state's largest filing cabinet. I thought that was a unfortunate diminution of the duties and the responsibilities, but it does have a very important filing and ministerial function. But beyond that, I think in this cycle, this time in our history, in Arizona and in the country, what secretaries of state do has finally been recognized in the elections area as being very, very important. Because they can either put their finger on the scale to deprive people of their right to vote, or they can do some very serious efforts to try to remove obstacles and to make sure people can vote. And not since the era of the 50s in the South, I think, have voting rights been so much front and center and so much at risk as they are today.
Now, what's the authority of the Secretary of State to get involved in that area?
Well, let me throw out one, not a hypothetical, one actual situation where the Secretary of State has interfered, I think, on the wrong side of the voter empowerment area, and that is what we call the dual ballot situation. That was imposed by Secretary Bennett by fiat in the elections manual. He did it in June of this year, and he basically said, okay, Arizona, If you signed up using the federal form, you're in one line and you use one set of voting
documents. And it's because the federal form does not require
the paperwork that says that I'm a citizen. It requires you to swear that you're a citizen under pain of perjury. So there are people, specifically Attorney General Horn and Secretary Bennett, and Kris Kovacs, the Secretary of State of Kansas, notorious in our circles for his somewhat bizarre and unconstitutional views, has taken on this dual ballot situation. Interestingly, there are 36 states in the nation that require you to be a citizen and show proof of citizenship in order to register to vote. So we're not the only one by any means. Only two have this dual ballot situation. And you know what that cost us in the primary election? Almost $2 million was spent by recorders around the state that 21 people could vote a federal ballot. I think that's an extraordinary waste of money, and it has a very specific voter depression. It doesn't say you're a citizen or you're not. That's not the determination. It's did you come into the office with your birth certificate or not? If you didn't, then you have to do the federal form. And the people most penalized by this are out-of-state students who didn't happen to pack their birth certificate when they packed up to come to ASU.
So 21 cases, $2 million. You'd think an advocate of small government might think that was an unnecessary expense.
Anybody who's responsible with the public money would think that was absurd.
They might claim they didn't know how many people it was going to apply to.
They might claim that, but they already knew. Thanks to the recorders, our county recorders did a great job of trying to move people from the federal ballot line to the state ballot line, and they found other forms of identification. They checked against driver's license records. They checked against other states' records where they required proof of citizenship in order to get a driver's license, and they moved people by the thousand from the federal, but they didn't get them all. There were approximately 1,000 people that are still in the federal line. So they knew there weren't very many.
Now, you've cited a couple of examples
here.
But there's a lot that
you can do to either facilitate the process or to slow it down.
But in reality, elections are really run at the county level, are they not?
Yes, they are. The elections manual is put together by the Secretary of State. That's the Bible. That's the thing that runs the whole show, with the advice and consent of, but it's not a formal consent. It's an informal consent of all the county recorders. It's like the work I did as Attorney General with the county attorneys. The Attorney General does not supervise the county attorneys. But the Attorney General has the chance to work collaboratively with them and to help, as we did in a number of instances, with really tough cases. And it's a very, at its best, it's a very intricate set of interconnections.
Now, this may not be the best time to actually ask you for a candid answer to this question, but just on a policy level, do you think the chief elections officer of the state ought to be an elected office?
No, I have serious reservations about that. I think one of the most important qualifications is that you have a reputation for absolute fairness. Mm-hmm. And I believe I've earned that as mayor and as attorney general. I've not used a partisan lens to make any of my decisions. And so I think people need to know that the chief elections officer is going to call balls and strikes absolutely impartially. And it doesn't matter whether you're a D, an R, an I, or whatever other letter you have after your name when you register, you're going to get the same treatment. Now, that's not the image that people have today. And I think it's one of the reasons that so many folks have just given up. Independents, the ones that have I's after their name, have a really much tougher time than other voters. Because, for example, when they try to get a primary ballot, they have to apply every 2 years, every election cycle. D's and R's get one automatically in the mail. If they miss the notification, they're out of luck because they missed the deadline.
As Secretary of State, would you have the authority to change that? I would envision it would mean you'd have to mail out a ballot with both parties on it and you'd tell people to collect one. But would that require legislation?
Both parties is problematic because you don't want to have live ballots out there that haven't been requested.
Right.
But I think you can do a much better job of letting people know what their rights are. Most independents I've talked to were questioning about that. The second part is, and right now all you get is one postcard. I've written extensively on this subject because I don't think when you're talking about voting rights, one postcard that looks for all the world like junk mail
and
is sufficient notification. Only in 2012, only 7.8% of all independents voted in the primary. If that was an ethnic minority, the Justice Department would have immediately said it was discrimination per se.
We will be back with Terry Goddard, candidate for Secretary of State, after the break. We are in the think tank at News Talk 92.3.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR.
We are back in our final segment of The Think Tank with Terry Goddard, candidate for Secretary of State. His opponent is Michelle Reagan. She had a scheduling conflict, but I would like her and her folks to know that they are welcome here anytime. I want to ask you about one thing that I found jarring. I think it might have been unprecedented in American politics, and that is that your first commercial that I've seen, anyway, had a gay couple.
Right.
And it wasn't incidental. It was the central thrust of the entire campaign. I can't think of anyone having done that in this country before. And my question to you, how much of that was politics and how much of that was just making a statement on the issue itself?
In my opinion, it was all about making a statement. My opponent voted for and resolutely voted for a Senate Bill 1062. That was the right to discriminate bill in the last session of the legislature.
Explain a little bit about what
1062 basically said, that if you're a private business and you want to not serve somebody for your personal religious feelings, you don't have to do it, and you can't be sued by that person for not being served or taken care of. It was seen, I think, very accurately and immediately by the gay community as being an effort to try to deny them service. And the result or the outcry was intense, both at the legislature while it was being considered and then when Governor Brewer had it on her desk considering whether to sign it. And in addition to the human rights groups, we had the business community say, Arizona doesn't need one more shot in the face, doesn't need one more reason for the country to look at us askance and say they really don't have their act together, they don't understand human rights, they don't understand equal rights. And so they lobbied very hard, and the governor did the right thing and cast a veto. Several Republican senators changed their mind after they voted for the bill and went and wrote a letter to Governor Brewer saying that we made a mistake, and we'd like you to veto this bill. But Senator Reagan was not one of those. So I thought the important thing about Secretary of State, as we said earlier, is that you have to be absolutely impartial, absolutely fair. And anybody who has essentially cast a vote and supported something, a bill that gives people who want to discriminate the right to do so, it seems to me, has already said they're not going to be fair. They've got certain strong biases, and they're going to act on those. And certainly, if you're a member of the gay community, you're going to feel, if this particular person is elected Secretary of State, that your rights as a citizen are in jeopardy.
I listened to many of the people who voted for that, and I was convinced that they were genuinely dumbfounded by the reaction. Several of them said, we were told this was a religious freedom bill.
Oh, my. And that's really disingenuous. People have said, including Senator Reagan, that there was no testimony against it. Not true. In the committee, there definitely was. And I called Senator Steve Farley, who is served in the Senate and led some of the opposition, if not all, to 1062. And I said, was it possible that a senator wouldn't have known that this would both be used for discriminatory purposes and that it would be very damaging to the Arizona economy? And he said, really, I don't think so, not if they listened to what I had to say. And so I went to YouTube and I dialed up Steve Farley's comments on the floor of the Senate in Arizona before 1062 was passed. And he was absolutely, he nailed it on every point. Basically, this is against our principles of equal protection. Discrimination of this kind has no place in Arizona. And the country is going to see it as a black mark, and they are going to take their business elsewhere. He didn't mention the Super Bowl, but shortly after the legislature passed this, it became very clear that the Super Bowl and the other major sporting events that we've spent so much time and effort trying to lure to Arizona would have gone somewhere else if this had been signed by the governor.
I've heard that the Republican National Convention might have been on the table for this state were it not for that, but with it, it's absolutely off the...
Well, and that's unfortunate. I've not been out soliciting the Republican National Convention, but it's the kind of positive notoriety that Arizona can always use, and it can help us immensely in our future dealings economically. And folks who voted for it, I think, were very cavalier, because it was about our economy, because it was made very clear that this would have a devastating impact.
And your
business leaders,
your
Arizona Chamber,
they knew.
I know they knew. I mean, I've listened to the tape. I invite you to do so. Those discussions were held by credible members. It was not an emotional or tear-jerky type of statement that Senator Farley made. It was very matter-of-fact. It was very factual. It was very calm in his delivery. He was trying to get his fellow senators to just see the light, and many of them refused to do it.
Your website makes a major point of dark money. In fact, it's probably the most prominent thing on your site. Let's help the listener backtrack. What is dark money, and why do you care? And why should we care?
Well, I care intensely, and I hope, and I run into people throughout Arizona who care intensely. I think this is a bipartisan issue to start with. It's an equal opportunity offender out there in our political system. What it is largely corporate cash that uses a particular legal fiction or a legal mechanism called the 501c4 Foundation.
Charity, ostensibly, right?
Charity, yeah, but not charity in the sense that you normally think of the Boys and Girls Clubs, for example. Mm-hmm. These are what they call social...
Public education.
Educational. Yeah. Social welfare organizations is what they're called in the code. But they found out that they didn't have to disclose their donors. And so literally millions, tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars of corporate money, which was freed up by the Citizens United case in 2010, suddenly found these anonymous vehicles. So, well, the vehicles are not anonymous, but the contributions are anonymous. So at this point, we have...
So we know the organization that funded something, but we don't know who gave
that's
the
right.
money.
And
whose money is it really?
The organizations always have wonderful names, you know. People for Truth, Life, the American Way. They are just wholesome as can be. But what they basically are all about is hiding the identity of the donor who wants to influence politics but doesn't want you to know that they're influencing politics. And the interestingly, the judicial precedent is very clear. They basically, with the Citizens United case, said, we can't really keep corporations out of the political. They have a right, they're people now, and they have a right to speak, and money is speech. Those are the two most important decisions out of Citizens United. And I think the justices very sincerely thought that the public would have the benefit of transparency, that they would know who was speaking, even if they were speaking with millions of dollars in a very loud voice. But they left it up to the states to make the transparency legal. And Arizona refused to do it. So we have become the Cayman Islands for dark money. We have had literally hundreds of millions of dollars move through our state because we do not require transparency. We do not require the donors to be revealed. And because they're not, these big-time operators are moving their money through Arizona.
I remember last year there was a famous case of a whole lot of money went in to influence California, California.
Yes, it did. And those folks did it illegally and were fined $1 million for abusing the California laws.
Okay, if I can interrupt on this. That's the problem. What is the authority of the Secretary of State to deal with this, and what can you do?
Let's take that in a couple of levels. We need transparency. There are no laws that require transparency. The people who are doing this today in Arizona are acting completely legally. I'm not saying they're not. My background is as a prosecutor, a criminal prosecutor, and somebody who spent an awful lot of his time as AG going after money launderers, the agents for the cartels that were moving money illegally across the border to the cartels, from the drug proceeds to the cartels. I've seen money laundering in just about every form, and I know what it looks like. I know how to go after it, and I have the tenacity to do that. So even without a statute, I think we can find out a lot and disclose. I would simply print. These are the companies that refuse to tell us who their donors are, and these are the candidates and causes that they support.
Companies or committees?
No, they're companies.
Companies.
These are companies. Committees have to, a political committee, be it an independent expenditure committee or a candidate support committee, have to tell you who their donors are.
But a 501c4
does. 501c4 does not. They could. Other states have passed laws that require them to disclose. New York, California, Connecticut, Maryland, Colorado. The list goes on and on. Arizona could and has refused.
You got 30 seconds to make
your
case.
I got 30 seconds.
Well, make your case.
The case is this. My next step would be to go to the legislature with a comprehensive statute. I've already started writing it. I put it on my website. You can look and see about the plan that I have. It's not in final legislative language, but I hope you'll go to terrygoddard.com and take a look. The second thing is, if the legislature doesn't pass it, I fully intend to lead a citizens' initiative to ban dark money in Arizona, to require transparency in the political contribution area.
Okay, that's Terry Goddard.
Thank you.
Candidate for Secretary of State. His opponent is Michelle Reagan. She's welcome here anytime. You are in the think tank, KTAR 92.3.